Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Those of you who are regular listeners to this program have probably noticed a shift in perspective over the last 5 to 6 years, a kind of reframing of the medical science and my medical training into a more systems-wide view that I refer to by the term functional medicine. Certain diseases, previously mysterious and understood only as manifestations of a series of symptoms, are really unlocked in their complexity by a shift to a functional medicine perspective. One such group of diseases is inflammatory bowel disease. Our program this week features an interview with Dr. Gerard Mullen, in which we discuss inflammatory bowel disease, its connection with probiotics, and the overall immune system. And I think it's a fascinating example of how stepping back and reframing clinical medicine from a functional perspective often provides us with new and very effective strategies for the management of such diseases. Gerard E. Mullen, MD, is an internist, gastroenterologist, and nutritionist. He is board certified in gastroenterology and also board certified by the American Society of Enteral and Parenteral Nutrition, the American College of Nutrition, and the American Board of Nutrition Physician Specialist. He is presently director of Integrative GI Nutrition Services at the Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Mullen has become renowned nationally and internationally for his work on integrative gastroenterology and nutrition. Dr. Mullen is associate editor for the journal Integrative Medicine, a clinician's journal. He's also been recently selected by Dr. Andrew Weil to serve as a senior editor for the first book for physicians on integrative gastroenterology coming soon from Oxford Press. Dr. Mullen has become an authority in the fields of integrative gastroenterology and nutrition, and he has lectured nationally and internationally on these subjects. I had the good fortune back in February, when I was attending a course in functional gastroenterology, to listen to several hours of extremely erudite and interesting presentations by Dr. Mullen. I know you'll enjoy his style and his substance. I'm happy to welcome Gerard Mullen to Ask Dr. Dawn. Dr. Mullen, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
We're very impressed with your credentials and also intrigued with the types of diseases that you must be treating. There are obviously a lot of inflammatory bowel disease. And one of the things that I find most interesting is whether or not you think that inflammatory bowel disease is one disease or two or a spectrum of diseases. So let me ask you to perhaps give us your view on inflammatory bowel disease.
Well, inflammatory bowel disease is a spectrum of diseases, but there's only two that we tend to categorize them as having, and that's either ulcerative colitis, which is restricted to the colon, or Crohn's disease, which can be anywhere in the gut. So in the clinical world of gastroenterology, we stratify it to those two syndromes.
Okay, and are Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis the same sort of disease? How are they the same, and how are they different?
Well, they're only the same in that they cause inflammation of the bowel that tends to be chronic and lifelong. I'd say ulcerative colitis is different because it is restricted to the colon and can be surgically cured. If you remove the colon, then you've cured of that disease. If you have Crohn's disease, it cannot be cured. It can involve the colon, the small bowel, or any combination of bowel at the same time. That's the tougher of the two to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Crohn's disease is named after Dr. Crohn, I presume?
That's actually correct.
And what are its primary characteristics?
Well, like ulcerative colitis, it involves inflammation of the gut. In Crohn's disease, the gut inflammation tends to be full thickness, whereas in ulcerative colitis, it's just a superficial lining type of inflammation. And the Crohn's tends to be aggressive in that it can ulcerate, it can cause scar tissue, it can do a number of different things, cause little pockets called fistulas and fissures, and it's a nightmare of a disease.
Is there something different going on in the immune system that causes these diseases to have such different manifestations?
You know, the immune systems do have different characteristics between the two syndromes, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. You're right. However, I have to say that not one particular immune characteristic separates the two diseases, so we don't know really how they start, and we don't know what governs the immune responses in both syndromes, and we don't know at the end of the day how to really treat them effectively and differently based on the immune system, but we know that the immune system is overactive in both diseases.
Let's go back a little bit. Let's rewind to birth, because obviously these diseases have an evolution. I know they do occur occasionally in childhood, but that's actually quite rare, as I understand it. It tends to be more of a disease that manifests in adulthood.
Yeah, you're right, except for Crohn's, you do begin to see it in the teenagers. That's where it starts to kind of ascend, and it kind of peaks around the age of 25, and then there's a second peak in the more 40s to 50s when you see it emerge again through time. So the neonates and the young children, they're relatively spared, but, you know, certainly here where I work, they see them fall over. So you see more than what you think is really out there. It's not you're right, there's not as much as there in the young adults.
Right. In a tertiary referral center, you're obviously going to be seeing the cases that can't be handled locally and require real high-level expert consultation. So in a child, in an infant, the intestine is, let's call it immune-naive. It hasn't really been exposed to much. And as I understand it, there's a kind of a differentiation, almost a learning process that goes on in the gut-associated lymphatic tissue. I guess we should start by mentioning to the audience that your immune system, a large percentage of it, way more than half of your entire immune system, is lining the intestines, because obviously that's where you get your bad exposures to all kinds of bacteria, the stuff that goes into your mouth. So we need a very good barrier function there. But that barrier function has to learn how to do its job. Can you maybe talk a little bit about the development of a normal gut-associated immune system?
Well, generally that happens basically when you're born, and depends on the flora that you ingest from the mother, whether it's a vaginal delivery or a C-section. And, you know, during C-section, you don't have the benefit of having the vaginal flora that you do with a, you know, vaginal delivery. They found that the babies who are born via C-section, they're actually prone to have more allergies and asthma and things like that. So the immune system needs to be stimulated and cultivated, and the immune system adapts over time to different stimuli. So the other thing that comes into play is feeding. Now, if you're breastfed, certainly that has antibodies and certain protective factors which help defend your gut against pathogens. But on the other hand, it has prebiotics. And these prebiotics help the probiotics that the baby ingested during the vaginal delivery to really populate the gut permanently. And at 6 months, all the flora you have is pretty much determined within your first 6 months. And certainly breastfeeding is a certain important element to that. So there's certain things that out of our control, the way we're treated when we're born, really gets to determine what populations stay in our gut. And, you know, plus minus antibiotics and some probiotic therapies, those populations stay permanently. So we know that in terms of having immune stimulation is important for culturing good gut development. There's a hypothesis called the hygiene hypothesis that tells us that maybe a lot of the allergies that we see in our children is because that their guts are underdeveloped because we're over-sanitized in this country. And one could support that hypothesis because certainly a lot of our over-industrialization in the West has led to a lot of the allergies that we see, and certainly the hygiene hypothesis could support that. But the bottom line is that the immune system needs to be cultivated, developed over time, and certainly the earlier on, the better. And it's how you feed the baby, and when you start introducing feeds such as gluten, will actually determine when that baby develops celiac, because the earlier that you feed the baby gluten, then the odds raise triple that the patient will develop celiac. So everything has its timing and place. The immune system is a very delicate and integral system which determines our health and wellness.
Is there any evidence that
being born through cesarean section increases one's risk of Crohn's or ulcerative colitis if there is, in fact, a genetic predisposition?
Well, we don't know that. I mean, that's a good question in terms of the birth canal and certainly in terms of the breastfeeding. Unlike the celiac that we do know, if you give gluten before 6 months, you're asking for trouble. That data we know, but the other data we don't know.
Now, is that true for all babies or just babies who have the DR4 and DR8 mutations?
That I'd have to look at the studies. When it's been presented at scientific meetings, they didn't make a distinction if there is at risk profiles or not based on the DQ2, DQ8,
DQ2
profile. So at the meetings that I've attended at the GI societies, they don't really discriminate by haplotype risk.
Okay, so it's DQ2 and DQ8.
Those are the two, yeah. If you have both of those, then your rods really go up that you may have celiac. That's correct.
Well, coming back to inflammatory bowel disease then, the characteristics that I'm aware of are that there's an overabundance of T1 helper cells that are upregulated in Crohn's, but that in ulcerative colitis, it's more of a T helper 2 cells, or sort of the allergic related cells. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. That was part of the heart of my original research in the lab for many years. But, you know, that did lead to specific therapies for Crohn's. I mean, the TH1 type molecules, if you antagonize them, you can make Crohn's better. So there is a new one on the market that antagonizes interleukin-12, which is one of those TH1 molecules, as you described, that's being used for Crohn's. So, I mean, this has led to some discoveries, but the mechanisms that govern both diseases are so complicated. Now it's kicked up to the what they call T regulatory cells, and those are the master cells that look over the T cell regulation, and then you have bacterial interaction with T cells through what they call toll-like receptors, and they have genetic variability. It is amazingly complicated how this all happens, but in my mind, it's an abnormal reaction to gut bacteria and the immune system together, which leads and drives the process feet forward and makes it challenging for people like us to treat.
Right. Well, let's spend a few moments more on mechanism before we move into treatment, just because we have such a strong immune system in the gut. I guess it's sort of a little bit like driving around a truck full of gasoline. You know, you don't want to light a match. And because we have such an abundance of immune active tissue, if that immune system is activated against antigens, then it attacks the absolute wall of the abdomen. And in the case of Crohn's disease, at least, actually just chews a hole through it as if it were fighting some massive bacterial infection, except it's self-directed. Is that what's going on?
Yes, plus there's another factor about the scar tissue formation, and there are certain cytokines and mediators that favor that in Crohn's. So to me, it's the perfect storm.
Now, when you differentiate Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, I guess I'm wondering, is it because there are different leukotrienes and different inflammatory mediators being released because one is TH1 and the other is TH2? Is that why you don't burn through the whole bowel wall and get the fistulas?
It could be that the type of mediators released, they have their damage differentially. But I think also in ulcerative colitis, there's a deficiency of the short-chain fatty acids.
Really? I did not know that.
We know that through biopsies. We know that through animal models. We know that if we give them butyrate in animal models, you can make their colitis better. There is a relative deficiency of those essential fatty acids because they're metabolized. The byproducts of prebiotics get metabolized eventually through these short chains, and these short chains are really what heal, you know, the propionate, butyrate, and acetate is what drive the colon and make acetyl-CoA, which ultimately makes ATP. And when you have a relative short change of butyrate, you're going to be setting yourself up for a hit.
So it's going to be hard to heal.
So that's where I see these being a little different.
Okay, so let me just make sure I've understood. Of course, in order to heal tissue, you have to have a good supply of fuel, juice, basically. You need energy to rebuild. And I'm currently dealing with a person with a large ulcer in their interior tibia, which is a bad place because it's got a poor blood supply, so you can't get the energy in to heal properly. And in ulcerative colitis, if I'm understanding correctly, the energy substrate, which is the short-chain fatty acids, the butyrate, are not present in high enough levels, so the healing tendency, which is naturally there, just can't do the job. You can't get that ulceration healed fast enough because you don't have the energy source to do it.
That could very well be. You certainly need that energy source to heal, and without it, you can have a rough time, especially if you're taking an inflammatory hit like you do in UC.
Well, I'm liking the supplying the butyrate because, aside from the fact that it smells to high heaven, it's a pretty benign substance. And I'm wondering, is that intima therapy widely available? Can I just order that up for my patients with ulcerative colitis, or is that still in research?
Compounding pharmacy.
Compounding pharmacy.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, good to know. Because I think I have a clientele that likes to go with the most natural, least pharmacologic property they can. And they're practical people, you know, they'll use the antibiotics when they need them, but they'd much rather use colloidal silver if it's appropriate.
Correct.
And, you know, I think that's probably a rational stance, actually. That is irrational, not irrational. Let me be sure I say that carefully. What other natural or semi-natural compounds, extracts and such, have shown promise in the treatment of either Crohn's or ulcerative colitis?
Well, I got to tell you, most of the data is with ulcerative colitis. But there's data on both. I guess the first one I like to talk about is that of the probiotics, because the probiotics have been well studied in both, situations, both diseases. And there's probably a good dozen or so plus, been studied for both diseases. And for ulcerative colitis, it's unequivocal that it works very well for disease prevention and in some cases disease treatment. Crohn's disease, it's a coin toss. About 50% of the time, it'll help prevent and maintain disease, and 50% it won't. But I think it's pretty ambitious to think that one treatment like that's going to hold remission without drugs or be equal to or superior to drugs. I think that, you give someone probiotics, you can help maintain disease. I think that's pretty good. So probiotics is one thing that comes up. There's a, as you probably know, a polyphenol phenolic herb called curcumin, which is really hot now in the literature because everybody's studying it like vitamin D. And the curcumin was shown to prevent or to maintain remission once patients with ulcerative colitis are in remission in Japan. And certainly this needs to be reproduced, but that's really pretty promising. It hasn't been tried for Crohn's disease, unfortunately. That would be pretty good. Fish oils, another kind of hot nutraceutical, has been looked at. And again, there's strong data for both ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, more so for ulcerative colitis. The Crohn's disease studies that look pretty strong and promising were repeated in an international study where it didn't look as promising, so we don't know. I mean, the doses of a lot of these studies are all over the map.
Yeah, that was my next question, is if you're trying to replicate something and you use a lower dose, isn't that useful, though? Because if the lower dose gets an equivocal result and the higher dose gets a positive result, it sort of tells you, well, you've got to find the maximum effective dose. But to me, that's evidence that it works and that it's dose-related.
Yeah, but, when the people do their meta-analyses, of course, they're going to focus on the negative and not really fairly weigh the doses that were given and see if there were toxicities. And, fish oil is kind of a hard study to do because the placebo is going to taste good and the medicine is not going to taste as good no matter what you do. So that's a pretty hard study. But I think in my view of these things that I mentioned, and I'm sure there's more, I've seen Boswellia, there's been positive data from that, certainly, and ginger. There's all these, resveratrol. The problem that I see it is that you can't really take a nutraceutical and go head-to-head with a very powerful drug. I think you can take this with diet and then take these nutraceuticals and with medication and see if the program is superior to what is not a program, it's just handing a medication out. So that's the real challenge, is that how do we define research?
Mm-hmm.
What are our metrics and what are the outcomes? And I think that the rules tend to disfavor the nutraceutical or natural approach to it because it's kind of rigged. You got to go head-to-head against a drug. That's pretty tough.
Yes, you raise a couple of excellent points. The practical difficulty of blinding for diet, and for example, or blinding for stress reduction, mean that by definition we will never have a placebo-controlled study. We cannot have the gold standard of these therapies because we cannot do blinding. So it's catch-22. On the other hand, when you definitely alter the natural history of a disease with drug plus this versus drug without this, that's got to count for something, even in a non-blind study. And I just think we need maybe to take a look at how we define research rather than throw out anything that can't be researched according to our definition.
Yeah, it's our paradigm. I mean, it's kind of our issue. And then because this doesn't fit into our perfect model, then we discount it even when you have good data. And that's the problem with the fish oils.
Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. Now, there is the possibility of doing extracts of natural compounds. I came across something in reviewing a presentation you made back in February looking at a compound called modulin that comes in.
Go ahead.
I'd like you to talk about that. It sounded like something that had the potential to be sort of extracted and turned into a drug and therefore amenable to placebo studies.
It's interesting. It's basically whey protein, which is enriched with a cytokine called TGF-beta. And that TGF-beta is an immune regulator.
Mm-hmm.
And if you regulate the immune system favorably, you know, these people will do better. And there's three studies that I had presented showing that the TGF-beta in the pediatric population, which was the target population for these studies, worked well in terms of maintaining Crohn's disease. So it's currently, to my knowledge, is really they're targeting Europe with this particular product and before they retool and bring it back into this country. But I've been just kind of following the literature on it because it just makes sense that you can kind of in a natural way feed an individual medical food, and that has a natural anti-inflammatory component to it via it really has a cytokine in it. And I think that's kind of exciting because it acts locally right on the immune system in the gut.
Yeah, sort of a calamine lotion for the gut.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like the idea of local effects just because we seem to always run into a lot of unintended consequences when we go for systemic effects. Speaking of which, let's spend some time talking about the therapies that are commonly used in what I call conventional medicine for these conditions.
Okay. Well, the conventional medicines, there's so many because there's a new drug practically every 6 months, but there's a lot of biological therapies. Biological therapies are really against specific targets in the immune system, and they're really pretty potent in shutting it down. Or it can be non-specific targets, like taking a medication, Imuran, or 6-mecaptopurine, which really are just anti-metabolites and slow down DNA divisions. The cells will get a little sluggish, and that's how that works. Or you can have the topical agents, like the enemas, or you can just take a pill, which has like a salicylate derivative, which is anti-inflammatory. So all these things can, you know, work in your favor.
Are the salicylate derivatives like mesalamine that we use in inflammatory bowel disease non-absorbable or mostly non-absorbable? What's our hit to the kidneys? What's our hit to liver toxicity and such?
Good question. You have the potential to get some of a hit.
Anticoagulant effect or?
I think the main thing you worry about is the kidney.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes with like a Stevens-Johnson reactivity or systemically, but mainly it's the kidney. You would worry about that. But no matter what you take, those drugs are the least of all evils.
All right. And those work what percentage of the time, the oral anti-inflammatories?
About 40%.
And those are the ones you don't get to see in your center in Baltimore?
No, I mean, you know, we use them when we have to, but it's kind of like I'd rather use that than some heavy biologic, which, you know, you can give somebody lymphoma or you know.
Yeah.
There's a difference, you know.
Yes, indeed. I worry about any of the really strong tumor necrosis factor drugs. I mean, if you've got bad, crippling rheumatoid arthritis, oh yeah, take it because you've got a quality of life issue. But we haven't had these drugs even 10 years now. I think we're just coming up on 10 years on some of them. And there's every reason, theoretically, to suppose that they will increase the risks of cancer in people.
Correct, correct. And I would be concerned.
Just have to be sure you really need it and that it's worth the potential for causing cancer down the line. So maybe a little bit about how you approach a kinder, gentler approach to inflammatory bowel disease.
I look at people's life. I look at the person. And oftentimes it's what they're eating and what their lifestyle is like is, I think, 95% of the battle. And I find people somewhat reluctant to change the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I find the younger, the better.
When you say they're eating, tell me more about that. What changes do you recommend?
Don't go to McDonald's. Don't go to Burger King. I don't want, you know, I don't go to fast food restaurants. Don't try to eat whole foods, cook at home. You know, I try to hook them up with dietitians that we have here locally that are pretty good. And I find some people who are motivated, and there's a lot of others who aren't. And the nutraceuticals, you know, the ones we just mentioned, certainly are out there in terms of them having potential efficacy, but someone's going to run around like a nut and be stressed out and eat pretty crummy. That's, I don't care what you give them. You're going to be challenged.
Is stress a really big factor in inflammatory bowel disease, and what do you think the mechanism is?
Well, more so easily shown in irritable bowel than inflammatory bowel, but both in the good old days, it was clear that stress was a factor in inflammatory bowel. Now, without much evidence, doctors are kind of poo-pooing that. But the mechanism would be that you're really setting off a pro-inflammatory response through the sympathetic nervous system in individuals who are otherwise sympathetic dominant in their responses. So that's the harm.
So there's this yin-yang thing with the sympathetic and the parasympathetic.
Right.
And, of course, the parasympathetic innervation of the gut is very wide through the vagus nerve. And that is being overwhelmed by the sympathetic. Maybe the parasympathetic is keeping a lid on inflammation. Is there any evidence for that? Inflammatory cells like T-cells have receptors for acetylcholine?
That's a good question. That I know people are actually studying that question. And there's some people and some back in Long Island where I used to work are studying that and the ability of biofeedback to control the immune system through those receptors. So I can't really say what they're researching, you know, disclose that, but that's actually being looked at.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. So reducing stress, eating a whole food diet, what other things do you find that if they're young enough and flexible enough, you can modulate the future course of their disease by doing?
I think the main thing is for them to, you know, eat well, take probiotics, modify their stress by engaging in different mind-body stress-reducing exercises, and to be positive and think about certain nutraceuticals, such as curcumin, which I really advocate strongly for ulcerative colitis, fish oil for both syndromes, keep your vitamin D at sufficient levels.
Mm-hmm. What kind of doses are we talking about on the fish oil and the curcumin?
I'd say curcumin 2 to 3 grams a day, and fish oil, combine EPA, DHA, at least 4 to 5 grams a day, and vitamin D enough to keep your levels about 40.
Okay. Vitamin D at 40. And, of course, that's objectively testable, and people have vastly different dosage requirements, I've found.
Right.
Okay. Very good. With respect to the probiotics, of course, the strengths of the products are all over the map. What's available in the open market can range from 100,000 organisms to 10 billion organisms. Are there particular organisms and or doses that you feel represent the sort of the lower threshold for effectiveness?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I tend to use the lower doses, like the 35 billion or 20 billion per pack or per capsule, because the higher doses I find people react to them.
35 billion, not million.
Billion, yeah.
Yes, okay, just making sure. That's actually, what's available locally tends to be a fair amount weaker than that.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, they even find that you don't even need live organisms, just put the DNA in there and you get a lot of immune stimulation, so we don't know.
Yeah.
There's a lot we don't know.
More every day, it seems. Let me ask you about a couple of sort of slightly off-topic things that when I was preparing for this interview, I was really interested in getting your opinion on. First of all, setting up the idea that there may be in processed foods the growth over time of molds that could themselves actually be very inflammatory because of stimulating the immune system by being a foreign invader. So mold spores or mold products in processed foods. Any comment on that?
Not really. I mean, I avoid peanuts because they tend to, you know, be harbingers of mold for that particular reason that you mentioned. Other than that, no.
Okay. And one of the questions I get a lot on the air is related to this concept of colon cleanse, that we carry a lot of toxins in our colon and that we should go on these periodical juice fast colon cleansing programs using a purgative of some sort. And in fact, there are even websites where people post the results of their colon cleanse. It's kind of like standing next to the fish you caught. Nonsense, validity there to this concept that we should be cleaning out our colon regularly. Of course, when you read the literature on these things, it makes it sound like we've got, you know, 3-inch thick caked poop in our gut. You do a lot of colonoscopies. Do you ever see what they describe on the colon cleanse websites?
No.
Okay. I didn't think so. Well, A, do you think it's useful, and B, do you think it's dangerous?
I think using an enema form, like a hydrotherapy, like high colonic, is dangerous. Doing the other thing with a colon cleanse, anything done wrong could be dangerous. But for someone who's really obstipated, constipated, who needs some kind of relief, a periodic colon cleanse like that, as long as it's done right, I don't see a downside. It's like getting someone prepped for a colonoscopy. But if you think you're going to be pulling off 10 pounds off your bowel wall, all this debris and stuff, that's not, that's aliens and outer space. You know, I don't know.
Okay, but fair to say you've never seen that that environment on colonoscopy, and I'm sure you've seen a few bowels in your time.
I say so.
Okay. Next question is relating a new anti-diarrheal drug that is actually, as I understand it, a synthetic version of the cholera toxin called Amestiza. It appears to affect the tight junctions, and I wondered if you had any concerns that this might contribute to a leaky gut or heightened permeability in people who use it.
You know, it's interesting. That's in the colon, though. I mean, Amestiza works predominantly in the colon. I don't know about it causing barrier dysfunction in the small intestine, but we know these patients with irritable bowel already have impaired barrier function in their small gut. I don't know much about what their permeability issues are in their colon. There's not much reported on it, but we don't know. I mean, it could very well do that, but we don't know.
Okay, so important distinction. Let's move now to talking about irritable bowel. And, of course, many people with irritable bowel disease will look a lot like people with inflammatory bowel disease. They may even have some of the red flag symptoms, like waking up in the middle of the night with pain. One of the chief distinguishers that I use in my practice is the presence of blood in the stool, but obviously inflammatory bowel disease has to be pretty far advanced before you can make that distinction. And in my community, the gold standard is always colonoscopy for making that diagnosis. But please tell us about irritable bowel disease, what the mechanism is felt to be. Does that involve the immune system? And if so, will some of these immune modulating agents be helpful?
You know, it's interesting. Irritable bowel syndrome is definitely a disease. It's a triad. It's a mind-body disease that connects through a mediator called serotonin. Serotonin is rich in the gut. Obviously, we know that it still has levels in the brain, and that modulates depression. And certainly if we give patients SSRIs, we can definitely upregulate and elevate the effect of the serotonin there. In my mind, though, irritable bowel syndrome is, again, a triad of a mind-body alteration of perception, visceral hypersensitivity, or your gut is hypersensitive to normally non-painful stimuli, which becomes painful. That happens even with neuropathic pain patients or spinal injury, of course, patients who get hypersensitive syndromes from pain as well. So there's this hypersensitivity which is really governed in the brain, but you feel it in your gut. And there's this distortion. I mean, you're supposed to have a healthy interplay between the first and second brains in an IBS. That doesn't go well, so you get this vicious cycle of pain and hypersensitivity and anxiety. Anxiety because these patients become anxious over time, and certainly their anxiety and depression sets them up for IBS. But in the meantime, that's also kind of driving their colon to be spastic, and you get hypersensitive, and it just keeps going and going. It becomes a dance.
Okay, and do you feel that food triggers are an important aspect of irritable bowel syndrome?
Yeah, plays into it. We know from Atkinson's data that if these patients undergo an elimination diet, that you can help them 60%+ of the time. You know, if you look at all the studies, they go between 40 and 60 to 65% of the patients benefit just with an elimination diet. But when you put them back on the diet that got them into trouble, then all of a sudden that magical effect goes away. So they can't really live on an elimination diet for a long time. It's meant to be a short-term diet, which then rotates them back and gets them off their, you know, allergenic components, because they're able to reintroduce a food, and then if they feel like they're experiencing an allergy or an allergic reaction to the food, then they would eliminate it. That certainly has some value. Many people do well off of dairy and gluten. There's not much evidence to support that, but in people's experiential evidence and in practice, that's what's commonly done in the alternative field. But again, probiotics seem to work pretty well for this disease.
They do.
Yeah.
Similar doses, the 35 billion that you spoke of for the inflammatory or lower doses?
It's all over the place.
Uh-huh.
I mean, just like with IBD, the IBS studies are all over the place. But what I've seen is that certainly the bifidobacterium seems to have the best data, at least from what I see. But, you know, people favor their lactobacilli species, but, you know, most people in clinical practice use the multi-species 8 to 9 strains per capsule or tablet that are, again, in the billions generally is what they use, but in the millions if you find it generally in a GNC or, you know, in a health food store. But if you're thinking of, you know, one of these specialty companies that are doctors only, then you're looking at the higher doses.
In your clinical practice, do you recommend probiotics for,
oh, yeah,
for this? Yes.
Yeah, but, you know, everything's timing. You know, you don't, everybody doesn't get probiotics right off the top, not if they have barrier functions and they may have some unwelcome visitors in their gut.
Mm-hmm.
Everything has its time and place. You really have to just restore the good gut environment before you give them the probiotics. The probiotics is meant to sometimes treat, but generally resustain the immune system and create a more friendly place for the good things.
Okay, so one of the steps would be short-term elimination diet. What are some of the other steps to restore that healthy gut?
Heal their lives.
Ah, okay.
And that's good luck. They got to be motivated to accept that, to realize it, not to live in denial. And you need the resources to send them to people who are confident in giving them insight into their lives and getting them to think differently. And that's the challenge, because if you can't do that, no matter what vitamin you give or what diet, you're going nowhere with these people.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate. It can be a debilitating disease, and the docs, sometimes they just don't get it.
Well, I think often physicians tend to be avoidant and close down, they're humans too, when they have very little to offer. And that situation certainly occurs when you're dealing with a person with a complex mind-body issue and you have standard conventional medical training. You have no tools beyond maybe some anti-anxiety drugs and some bowel paralysis agents that don't work very well anyway.
I agree. Those are all Band-Aids anyway, a lot of these medications. And then when you look at the meta-analysis, their margin over placebo is so small, it's ridiculous.
Do you think that any of the perinatal or early childhood factors that you mentioned play a role in irritable bowel disease as well as inflammatory bowel disease?
I don't know. I mean, certainly with asthma it is, and I don't know. Certainly, you'd have to think so with allergies and other conditions that involve the immune system being more primed in those who were not really primed from the beginning. So I really don't know, but I would not be surprised. I find more it's early life abusive experiences. Those who grew up in an abusive home, who got raped, who had all these life-shattering experiences tend to be really the most susceptible. And those who go and have either food poisoning, which we were all familiar with, the way the food's handled in this country, or go traveling and get some kind of infectious diarrhea, those are the ones you can define an event that set them up, or a risk factor that they have family history of it. And then they ate something that didn't agree with them, and all of a sudden they got IBS. So we're still teasing this out.
Mm-hmm. It would seem in my own clinical experience that people who have a discernible event are actually easier to treat.
Well, because you know what that discernible event is, at least with the psychosocial aspects. But if it's a post-infectious, the infection's long gone. That person went to Mexico, Cozumel, came back with some type of diarrhea, got better, but now they got IBS the rest of their life. It happened. The event, the smoking gun is way gone, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the old trigger and antecedent breakdown
right.
That we use in functional medicine.
Yeah, Leo Gallen's model, you
right.
know, antecedent triggers mediators. So, you know, certainly the antecedents are the things that put us at risk, like genetics. The trigger could have been the abuse or the food infection or whatever it was, or traveler's diarrhea, and the mediators are all these cytokines and prostaglandins and all these things that we've been talking about for the last hour.
Right, exactly. It's almost as if you can think of the event, like there's an earthquake in Italy, and that's the event, but then the mediators are all of the newspapers sending all the information around the world that there's been an earthquake in Italy. So our communication system gets revved up, and then that can dominate the picture. I wanted to ask you about a new clinical entity that I've only encountered a few times, eosinophilic esophagitis. And I've encountered it a few times. I hear from my GI colleagues that it's on the upswing. And I'm just wondering, what do you think this is? Eosinophils invading. This is a cell that we normally see in the noses of people with rhinitis. Now we're seeing it in the esophagus. Is this some kind of weird manifestation of food allergy? Or what can you tell us about this entity?
You know, what's interesting about that entity that's emerging, because it is a manifestation of the widespread epidemic of allergies in this country, is that it can be either food or respiratory-derived that triggers it. It's deep-rooted in the bone marrow and the immune system, and somehow it's programmed or misprogrammed to overreact to allergens, whether they be aerosolized or food. And you got to go through quite a process to get someone really off their allergens, identify them, and get them better. Of course, people rather give you steroids because that'll make you feel better right away, but the people get hooked.
It's
a condition.
Is there any connection with proton pump inhibitors?
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me.
Let's talk a little bit about those. I'm looking for support. I'm very much an anti-PPI, take it for 10 days and then taper off to something less strong kind of person in the advice I give, although I do have patients who are long-term users who refuse to come off of it. I am very concerned, and I think the research would support a concern about osteoporosis, and I'm wondering if you're aware of anything around dementia neuropathy being associated with PPIs, because certainly they've been around long enough for that to start to show up.
Well, the PPIs are quite a Pandora's box in my mind. Unfortunately, there's financial conflict to report the truth. I mean, you know, now we're hearing that if you're on Plavix and you're taking a PPI, you're going to have a better risk of a heart attack. And 3 years ago, that was looked into, and then the FDA gave them a very good clean bill of health. So now they're looking into colon cancer. Certainly the osteoporosis story is well known. We know that it also will make you malabsorb iron and calcium and certainly B12. You'll malabsorb that. You can get nephritis. It's one of the most common reasons why people get drug-induced renal injury is a PPI, but you never hear about in practice. Not that the guy's giving out the purple pen will tell you that, of course. The hypochlorhydria sets you up for small bowel overgrowth, which is epidemic in this country. Half the patients with irritable bowel have small bowel overgrowth, and the patients who have small bowel overgrowth have more extra systemic manifestations such as migraines and fibromyalgia, and they are sicker because they have small bowel overgrowth. And the easiest way to get set up for that is take a PPI. I think you're looking at Pandora's box here. So if you told me that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, they link prior use, you know, with PPIs with this condition, I'd say nothing surprises me. Is it because we're looking at the hygiene hypothesis and their immune systems are not being really programmed well when they're young, and it's just a matter of atopy and they're really more allergic and this is a, you know, more severe manifestation? Yeah, that could do it as well.
The proton pump inhibitors block a lot of the acid and the majority of the acid that might be produced in the stomach. So as a result, a lot of nutrients aren't broken down. And I'm just kind of clarifying that small bowel overgrowth, by that you mean bacterial overgrowth. So bacteria should be in the colon, kind of migrating up to the intestine.
Correct.
And my question is, I don't understand the mechanism there, because supposedly the acid that your stomach makes, or if you're on Prilosec or Prevacid, doesn't make, is going to be neutralized by your pancreatic secretions in the upper duodenum, creating a relatively basic or at least neutral compound to go through the small intestine. So why does the absence of acid predispose? I don't understand the mechanism of that.
Well, because the acid in the stomach generally kills the bacterium, and that's one of the crucial parts. You know, it's an antimicrobial effect, and by the time it reaches the small bowel, it's a much more neutral pH.
Got it. Okay, so the idea being you have to kill the bacteria on their way in.
You got to get them in the stomach.
Yeah, that clarifies it for me. Thank you. Do you think that you have any other things that you would like to talk about? I'm curious about the things that you're very interested in, that you follow in your research, and please tell us a little bit about the research that you are doing.
I do a variety of research things, mainly relates to nutrition in the hospitalized setting and looking at the effectiveness of feeding patients early and getting them out early and getting them better early. So that's where the heart of my research is. And the other hat I wear is a capsule endoscopy, I wouldn't say pioneer, but just expert. So we're looking at the various uses of capsule endoscopy in the hospital setting and how to train young physicians and nurse practitioners and other people how to read them. And those are the real two areas I really focus my research on at this point. Early in my career was on the laboratory and all this TH1, TH2 stuff you pointed out, but now it's kind of shifted and more practical and more clinical and more hands-on.
I think that it's maybe important to spend a few moments talking about the current rather deplorable state of affairs with respect to hospital nutrition. I have the situation of people coming into the hospital for a surgery, perhaps having a complication. This might be someone in their 70s or 80s. By the time they're actually eating again, it may have been as much as a week. In that time, they've cannibalized the muscles of their legs and can barely walk because they haven't been getting enough calories in. We know better. Why do we do this, and how can we not do it? How do you approach this problem?
I don't know. We're really struggling here. It's a matter of changing a culture where people understand the importance of delivering nutrition early, and that really should involve pretty much every person at every level of the patient's care. And there's a lot of buck passing, and people aren't, they're pressed for time, and I don't know. Someone's got to, you know, champion it, and certainly it saves money if patients get out healthier and earlier, and I think that usually comes down to administration. They usually push it more than the docs.
Do you think we should be more aggressive about feeding patients early after their surgery?
Absolutely, and even before.
How long do you think a person really needs to have not eaten before they can undergo general anesthetic?
That's arguable. The anesthesia community likes 8 to 12 hours, and they do a majority of our sedation, so I can argue with them.
Well, I'm asking, I guess, is there much in the way of actual basis for that scientifically, or is that just a number that everybody gets taught in residency?
I don't know. I mean, I think because gastric emptying-wise, it takes about 4 hours to empty out a solid meal. Liquid meal will be about 2 hours, and everybody has delayed. People who are hospital-bound tend to have more delayed motility, so I think 8 hours is not such a bad.
The practical difficulty of it is that a person will, if they're coming in for a day surgery and they're on the schedule third or fourth case, they fast overnight, nothing after midnight. They might actually get their surgery at 7 p.m. The following day, they're generally not eating very much, and so we're setting up a minimum of 48 hours simply because of the way we've organized our surgical setting. Couldn't you just, and I'm just having a conversation here, obviously, but what's wrong with just dropping an NG tube and clearing the stomach contents and then going ahead? Why isn't that done?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people can aspirate, I guess, during the process. Hard to say.
It's really fear of litigation, I think, that drives most of this, including the enormous conservatism of making people fast after midnight when they're the fourth case, and you know they're not going to go to the operating room until 4 p.m.
Correct.
Okay. So aside from the practicalities of the machine, not a lot of support for going the opposite direction, so therefore probably not going to happen. When you said that you're doing research on early nutrition, what are you doing?
We're looking to see the effectiveness of delivering feeding early in the hospitalized setting in terms of the length of stay and how patients do, and it looks like it makes a difference, at least in our center, so it's promising.
All right, good. What about feedings through the veins, the peripheral nutrition or the TPN?
Yeah, people need that. I mean, there's a time and place for all that too, no question.
Do you think that the formulas that we currently use are nutritionally adequate, or could they use some tweaking?
Well, I mean, if we had structured lipids and omega-3 fatty acids in those lines instead of soybean oil or omega-6, I'd be a lot happier.
Mm-hmm. Is there any technical reason that that couldn't be done?
I don't know. It's being done in Europe.
Okay. So the answer is no.
No. Maybe it's cost. I don't know. But it's being done in Europe.
Maybe we should order ourselves up some European TPN recipes.
Right. European TPN with latte. Right.
And a little dash of cinnamon and curcumin just for the anti-inflammatory effects.
Hey, right. Just to spice it up.
Okay. Really good. I want to ask you a question. Well, it's still a doctor-to-doctor question, but it's a little bit different. I'm out here in Santa Cruz, California, lots of people into natural healing. I can kind of get away with a part-time acupuncture practice and doing functional medicine.
Right.
Yet, you're in Baltimore. You're in the middle of a hospital setting. You're surrounded by all of these researchers. And I can't but imagine that it must take a lot of moral courage and just energy to keep yourself on the good track in that environment.
It's challenging.
What do you see as your biggest challenge? Is it the attitude of your peers? Is it frustration because they, you know, ignore good data? Is it just being dissed, so to speak? What's the hardest part for you?
I don't know. You know, it's funny. I keep a low profile, pretty much, and whenever we have discussions, I have evidence, and that's the gold standard here. And I mean, you treat people nice, and you set an example for them, and you don't go on a crusade, but you're persuasive when the time's right. I think people respect that, so I think that's how I've handled myself year, and I've done well with it for the last 3.5-4 years, so I hope it stays that way.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. I've totally enjoyed this interview. I hope you have as well, and I know my listeners.
Very, very nice. Thank you. It was very, very pleasant.
And have a wonderful, wonderful rest of the weekend.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Well, I certainly hope you enjoyed that interview with Dr. Mullen. And I certainly took away from it strategies and new interventions that I'm already putting to use in my clinical practice. Since we have a little bit of time left over, I thought that perhaps we could answer some additional emails. This one from Mark in Cumberland, Maine. Dear Dr. Dawn, last year, I led a team of teenagers on a service mission to Guatemala, www.safepassage.org, which was a great success. However, everyone on the trip got some sort of intestinal bug, some more serious than others. This summer I'm returning, and I'm wondering if there is a probiotic regimen that we might use before or during our travel that would make us less susceptible to alien bugs. Well, Mark, I'm glad you asked, and it dovetails nicely with the topic of this week's interview. I have two suggestions for you. Beyond the basic Peace Corps advice of boil it, peel it, burn it or forget it, or words to that effect. In other words, if it isn't steaming when it gets to you and you can't peel it, don't eat it. There are the problems of water and also the bugs you pick up on your hands. Actually, I'm convinced that most people who get traveler's diarrhea actually get it not from contaminated food, but from contaminated doorknobs, elevator buttons, and banisters. So I tend to have a little bit of an OCD complex when I travel, and I cultivate it. I carry my hand sterilizer, and yes, laugh at you will at the silly gringa, but I put my hand sterilizer on before I put anything in my mouth, including a cough drop or my fingers. But getting down to the science, Pepto-Bismol, bismuth subsalicylate, is a well-established preventative for the invasion by foreign bugs. This is how it works. Each of your travelers goes down to Guatemala with a package of bismuth subsalicylate tablets. The tablets work best, obviously, because they're lighter and less cumbersome. Easier to get past Homeland Security, too, for that matter. 2 tablets are chewed before ingesting any food. So before your meals, before that snack, the bismuth coats the lining of the stomach and very, very discouraging to any bacteria that's trying to get through that stomach lining and invade your bowels. It's an extremely effective agent. Works better in head-to-head studies than taking antibiotics on a daily basis for prevention and with a lower complication rate. The major complications you'll get from bismuth subsalicylate, well, if you're aspirin sensitive and develop asthma attacks from taking aspirin, this is definitely not a strategy you want to try. Your poop will be black, but firm. And, you know, firm black poop definitely beats the alternative, but do be aware that the color change is not a sign of bleeding. And you'll have that funny taste in your mouth that the Pepto-Bismol tablets give you. Well, that can be rinsed out with a little water, boiled or otherwise sterilized, please. As a third line, I recommend taking probiotics with you. You want something that contains at least 3 billion and preferably more colony-forming units per dose, that is to say per capsule or pill. And in fact, you may find it more economical to purchase powders and distribute them in packets. Probiotics should be taken on a daily basis, and for anyone who does develop a diarrheal illness, high doses of probiotics are quite effective in limiting the severity of the reaction. When I say high doses, I'm talking about 3 to 5 billion units 3 to 5 times a day. Quite a hefty dose, but remember, these are benign organisms, and realistically, it's probably not the probiotics that are helping you, but their DNA or signals that are contained on the surfaces of their cell walls. We don't fully understand the mechanism yet, but what we do know is we're dealing with a benign intervention here.
There have only been rare cases of complications with massive doses of probiotics, and these have occurred in extremely debilitated individuals, such as people with severe acute pancreatitis in the intensive care unit. A bunch of healthy teenagers on a trip to Guatemala would certainly not be at high risk for any kind of probiotic complications. Good luck to you, and keep up the good work. We've come to the end of another program. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I. I'll be back next week to take your questions and emails live on the air. Until then, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.